Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, Episode 40 for May 18th, 2006. Listener Questions and Answers, Number 7. I look forward to Thursdays every week because I know I'm going to learn so much about security. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Gibson, the security guru.
Hey, Leo. Good to be back.
It's good to have you. This is episode 40, so it means it's one of our Mod 4 episodes. We're going to do questions and answers. But there's a lot of big security news, and I know you wanted to cover some of that.
Yeah, a couple things. For one thing, Apple announced 31 vulnerabilities this week. OS X version 10.4.6 and previous, and those, you know, there are local and remote code execution problems, information disclosure, denial of service, and local privilege escalation problems. I mean, basically, just a whole collection of the typical kinds of problems that, you know, exactly like what we were talking about last week and the week before, with this is a fundamental problem of writing secure software. And as we all know, Apple has for a long time enjoyed a history of much fewer problems than Windows has been exposed to. In fact, you've probably seen these commercials that they're running now, Leo. You know, the guy who's standing in for Apple and one who represents the PC.
Yeah.
You know, and how the PC gets viruses so quickly, but there aren't any for the Mac.
I have some problems with those ads. They're marketing.
Yeah, and they're getting the message across. What I'm noticing is that these are coming out just as it's beginning to be no longer true.
Right. Well, it's interesting because Apple never wanted to play that virus card. And I think that one of their resistances was they didn't want to antagonize virus authors. It was the best kept secret in the computing world was there's no viruses and don't tell anybody.
Well, and historically, as we've said before, people who write viruses write them for the computers they own. And Macs have, again, years ago, not been in the mainstream. They've been, you know, in schools to some degree, but what kids had to play with were PCs, and so that's what they wrote viruses for. Increasingly now, of course, Macs are affordable, and they're an increasing target.
You watch, though. I don't think we're going to see the same degree of virus problems on the Mac platform, just because many of the things that make viruses possible that we've talked about on Windows, things like ActiveX, active scripting, the fact that every user is really running as admin, those things aren't as prevalent or even possible on the Mac side.
And population size. I mean, a virus author who wants a well-propagated virus will still write it for Windows just due to the population size.
I mean, nowadays, the reason people write viruses is to co-opt computers, and you're going to go where you can get the most computers.
Exactly.
Yeah. Another issue, yes?
Yeah, another really biggie is that a flaw has been found in the Real VNC remote authentication. Real VNC is a very popular open source remote desktop system that allows people to, you know, basically connect to a remote machine and then get access to its desktop. It's super well used. This is a really bad vulnerability because it completely defeats the authentication, meaning that anyone who can find a Real VNC server, or that is to say service port exposed, can, until this patch is applied and Real VNC is updated, can connect to it and basically log in immediately.
Oh boy!
Now the I got a kick out of the you know what to do in the meantime. People were saying, well, you know, close any ports that you have exposed to the internet, and this comes back to something that I've said before, and I want to keep reminding people, which is never leave default ports alone. People who, for example, are running web servers, you pretty much have to have the server running on port 80, because that's where everyone's browser is going to expect to see it. Now, if you are running your own web server, for example, from home, just for remote access for you, for example, if you wanted to access your documents or something remotely, then by all means, move that web server to some funky port of your own imagination. The only time you really need to leave ports in their default is if you need people who don't know what port you've chosen to access your service remotely. So in the case of RealVNC, someone running a RealVNC server at home so that, for example, they're able to access their home desktop remotely, by all means, change the default port to some random number between 1024 and less than 65535, because what happens is when a vulnerability like this is discovered, the bad guys start scanning the internet for connections on the default RealVNC port. When they get one, knowing what the vulnerability is, they can log on to your desktop and you're theirs.
There's another way you could secure it. We use RealVNC for the radio show for call screening, but what we do is we establish a VPN link first and then open the RealVNC. So it's within a VPN tunnel, which until VPN is, which could be, but until it's compromised, that's safe, right?
Well, as long as the RealVNC server itself is not exposed, that is, the RealVNC port is not exposed
to
the internet.
It's internal. Yeah.
Then you're absolutely right. That's a great solution.
Yeah. So don't. So in other words, I have to get on the local area network by using the VPN
right.
before I can get access to the VNC server.
Right.
We don't. It's not exposed. It's not naked to the world.
That's a great way to fly. So
yeah.
for anyone listening to this who is using RealVNC, immediately update your RealVNC to the latest version that you can get from their website. They fixed the problem, but we want to get the message out. And while you're doing that, if you are not running it on some non-default random port that you've chosen, make that move now. Write the port down or use something memorable, but you know that's not leaving it at the standard service port, because you always want to run services on, you know, non-default ports when you can. This is a perfect example of why that's a really good lesson.
Of course, it's not fully secure to do that, because some of the sniffing software will just attempt to make a connection across all ports, but it's a lot slower to do that. And so I imagine most people just stick with the default ports, and there are enough open holes that they can just use those.
Right.
But if they really wanted to attack you, they could test every port for a VNC connection.
Well, and for example, another approach is if instead of scanning the internet, if somebody knew your IP from it being posted in a bulletin board blog or in email that was made public or in a news group forum where the email was available.
On IRC, on BitTorrent. I mean, people know your IP address.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not something that it's easy to keep quiet.
Right.
If someone knew your IP and they knew somewhere on that IP, at some port on that IP, there was a RealVNC server, for example, you'd bragged about it in the past or talked about it or something.
They could find it.
They could, exactly.
Yeah,
then
yeah.
The fact that they know what IP it's on narrows their search dramatically.
Right, right. If you used Hamachi to establish the connection and then had RealVNC running locally.
That's a great application for Hamachi, and you'd be completely safe.
Good. All right.
Another interesting tidbit that I just wanted to mention is there's sort of a boiling controversy over the purpose of and the future of the Whois database that ICANN is trying to decide what to do with.
Now, this is of great interest to me. I'm sure it is to you, Steve. But when I have a website, and I do have quite a few, my address, my phone number, those are made public in the Whois database.
Well, for example, one of our listeners created or grabbed the domain securitynow.info.
Oh, dear.
I know. Securitynow.info brings up a little page that redirects people to to mysecuritynow.htm page.
Well, that was nice of him.
Very nice of him. But I didn't want to sort of formally endorse that because he has control of the domain and I don't. So I used the Whois database to try to find him. I got an email address. I don't remember now. It was maybe at GoDaddy or something, and sent him a note saying, hey, I noticed you registered securitynow.info. Would you be willing to transfer that to me? I'd be happy to pay your expenses, blah, blah, blah. I never got any reply. Chances are it went into some bit bucket somewhere,
right,
and he never saw it.
So he's listening now. Yes, we're looking for you.
That would be. I'd really love to have the domain and be happy to, again, cover his expenses. But, again, I can't endorse it because we don't have control of it. So, you know, so that's a problem. But for example, both sides of this is interesting because on one hand, people, for example, political dissidents or bloggers may want the option of retaining some anonymity. And of course, the anonymity is something that the internet to varying degrees has always offered people.
Yeah, television show hosts might want some anonymity. Don't forget that.
Sure, sure. So on one hand, you can say that the Whois database needs to not necessarily identify someone to the degree that would potentially compromise their own personal safety. The flip side is that in the post-Katrina disaster relief stuff, we know that many fake donate to Contrita victims websites were created, and the Red Cross was very upset with those sites, and they were able to use sort of the soft and fuzzy, doesn't necessarily have to be accurateness,
right,
of the Whois database to hide themselves,
right,
and also to like put non-verifiable obscure records in. So I can, and in general, the internet community are really at odds right now over what to do about the problem.
There is a simple solution, by the way, I think. Is it a third party involved? In fact, that's what I do with GoDaddy. There's a company that offers its service for a fee at GoDaddy. I think it's Domains by Proxy. And everything, they hold the they hold the information. And everything in my, if you go and do a Whois on twit.tv, you'll see Domains by Proxy. And then I can go through Domains by Proxy, and presumably a police agency or ICANN could go to Domains by Proxy and say, hey, look, this is a spurious site. We need that information.
Right.
I think that would be the way to do it, and I hope that they find a solution. Have they come up with anything? Or?
No, it's really interesting. I spent some time the other day reading through just the incredible bureaucracy of this kind of process with, you know, opening the forum to the public, allowing people to give their pros and cons. And, I mean, as with any complex issue, it isn't clear that there's a cut-and-dry solution. And, in fact, the notion of running through a third party, as you suggest, is discussed there. And, again, there's, like, the pros and cons of needing to do that. So,
well, it's government. It's, and whenever it's a quasi-governmental organization, and whenever government gets involved. I was briefly on the technology committee for my small town here. And it's so frustrating because the laws of California, and they're good laws that require the public to be informed about everything you do, things like the Brown Act, made it very difficult. We couldn't have, for instance, a private message board or even a mailing list among the group members because the Brown Act prohibits that. So it's both good and bad, and that's the way things are. But I do think the third party ultimately will be the way to go. I'm happy with it. Nobody can get my information, but it is available to, you know, somebody if they absolutely needed it.
If they can demonstrate a real need.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, they can go to court or whatever.
Yeah, I guess the issue for me is that I can see validity to both sides of the argument. So I think you're right, Leo.
That
having some intermediary who acts as a buffer for the information probably is the way it's going to wind up.
Well, you and I are on both sides of it, really, because on the one hand, I don't want somebody to have my phone number, my home address, or even my office address. But at the same time, I don't want anybody impersonating me on the net. So,
exactly.
So, we can see both sides of the equation. Yeah.
Exactly. And then one last thing. A listener named Weaver wrote from the UK. He loved this notion that I talked about a couple weeks ago of browsing the net with IE locked down tight, and then specifically whitelisting sites where I wanted scripting and more features to be available so that, and in fact, the way he put it, he said, I loved your idea of interviewing a website and then deciding if it was, you know, worthy of trust and then giving it trust. He wanted to make sure that for people who are Firefox users, that they knew about a plugin called NoScript. It's just that the URL is www.noscript.net, and it's apparently a highly regarded plugin. I did a little browsing around, and it's got 5 out of 5 ratings, and it's been recommended by lots of people. The idea being that similarly, JavaScript and Java are prevented in Firefox until you decide that you want to or need to enable those for a site that you trust, and just a single click on a little blocked icon down in the status bar will enable then and basically whitelist the site, and this thing works in Mozilla and Firefox.
Important to make the distinction, though, between the kind of scripting that can be done in Internet Explorer with Active Scripting and ActiveX and what's available in Firefox. I mean, JavaScript, as far as I know, doesn't have anywhere near the risks inherent in Active Scripting.
Some people did comment. I think it was on the on your Twit board, Leo, that plug-in code in Firefox is as vulnerable as ActiveX code is.
You know,
it
is running on your system.
Exactly. Yeah. It's client-side code that you're inherently trusting if you use those plugins.
Although most plugins are written in JavaScript. They're written in Zool, which is basically JavaScript. And so the plugins, it's their user interface, but they don't have, again, they don't have that kind of capability.
And that means they don't have that level of power.
Right. I mean, they could, and that's the point. If you should right. always be careful when you install any kind of plugin.
And I guess that is to say the bad ones would.
Right. one other point I wanted to bring up, but we got an email from a fellow who said, you know, Steve's method of locking down IE is great as long as the bad guy hasn't modified your hosts file. But as soon as somebody modifies the hosts file, he can change where that apparent script is coming from and breach the security.
That's a very, very good point.
So if somebody has access to your system or has gotten a Trojan on your system, it could modify your host file and then it'd be all over.
By that time, it's too late. I was going to say, the flip side of that is if they're already in your system to the level that would allow them to modify your host file, then you're pretty much hosed anyway.
And a lot of spyware does that, by the way.
Yeah, we have not talked about the hosts file, and we're definitely going to because it's ubiquitous. It's an interesting sort of not well known unless you've really dealt with this stuff before. Way station for DNS lookup that is powerful and vulnerable both at the same time.
And people can use it to protect themselves, and I think I would love to have you talk about that.
So we'll do it.
We'll save that for another one. Right now, though, we've got a dozen questions from listeners, a dozen out of the 5,000 you collected.
Actually, I did the math. I have two folders, one for people who submit things anonymously and one where I could reply to them because they've given me an email address. The sum of the email in those two folders is 6,010 messages at the moment.
Which is why you're not getting a personal reply from Mr. Gibson. From me either.
I do when I can.
Yeah, as do I. First from Jason in Atlanta, Georgia. He actually has two questions, so he's double your money, Jason. He says, I have Microsoft Small Business Server 2003 at our office, and I'm curious if the SSL certificate that our server created itself is as secure as if I'd bought one from VeriSign. That's a good question.
It's a great question, and the answer is yes. The SSL certificates, which any contemporary system will generate, are absolutely as secure as what you buy from VeriSign.
However,
the only difference is that VeriSign is standing behind the identity that certificate represents, which really, if you've made one yourself, for your own users to access your server, that's really not an issue. You just have to make sure you don't lose control of it.
Would it be seen by browsers as trusted, though, since it's not? They can't relate that certificate, as you've talked about before, back to those handful of trusted third parties?
Well, that's correct. So the idea would be that if you're using a certificate that your own business's small business server has generated, then everyone who needs to trust that would also have to import into their browser or into their system the matching key for the server so that it's able, so your browser is able to verify the certificate. Because as we know, web browsers come pre-built with a huge array of certificate certificates is what I'm trying to say, with a huge array of existing certificates that allow them to automatically check the security of anyone who's trying to connect.
Right, right. He also says, if I'm at a secure site and I go to a web page on that site that has another page embedded in it, like as in a frame or an iframe, would the information be encrypted between my machine and that embedded page and the secure page?
That was a good question.
That's a great question.
Yeah, I wanted to include that. The answer is no. The level of encryption is at the level of the connection, that is the asset or the resource which is being pulled from a remote server. So if you had a frame and the frame loaded a non-secure URL, your browser would make a non-secure connection so that the security on the outer frame or the outer page does not necessarily imply anything about the security of content inside.
That's why I get that error message from my browser sometimes that says part of this page is encrypted and part of it is not encrypted. Is that what that's talking about?
Just what I was going to mention. Exactly. They're, for example, in IE and other browsers, sometimes it's called mixed content. The idea being that not all the assets on the page are secure. And it might just be images, for example, that they're going to a third-party server that is not a secure connection, and so it's saying, hey, there, you know, you should know that some stuff on this page is not secure. So it may be that your browser will alert you, but it's not necessarily the case that unless you're sure that it's going to be a secure asset.
I think some browsers have a modified key icon or lock icon when you're on a mixed site like that. It's funny, I don't remember for sure, but I think I've seen that. Two people asked questions relating to President Bush's proposal for tamper-proof ID cards. Steve Gilliam of Pinehurst, North Carolina wrote, President Bush recently said he wants to give tamper-proof digital fingerprint IDs to legal guest workers. How could public and private key encryption be used to generate these IDs, and after it goes into effect, how would counterfeiters try to defeat it? And that's one of the problems right now is that illegals often, in fact, have papers that look real because counterfeiters have gotten very good at forging birth certificates, social security numbers, and that kind of thing.
Sure. Go ahead and read Ben's question.
Ben also asked, the president suggested we needed a document that includes biometric info to make a tamper-proof ID card so they could check your fingerprint or your iris or whatever for every legal foreign worker. Do you think this can be done to a reliable degree? He says, I tend to think this would require a federal database so the information on the ID card can be validated and probably so the card could be used as a kind of token. I would imagine that a fingerprint could be used like a key to unlock the encrypted info. But I wonder about the likelihood of a standard electronic fingerprint reader reading the same thumb each way, each time. I know when you come into the U.S. from a number of nations, you do, in fact, get fingerprinted. In some cases, they also do iris recognition. I mean, this kind of system does exist.
Well, I like this question, or both of these questions, because it plays perfectly into the foundation in crypto that we've laid before. Now, biometrics, of course, is sort of valuable but scary depending upon how it's employed. But our crypto side gives us enough of an understanding of how something like this could work. Imagine that you had an ID card. On the card was a picture of the person who had applied for the card and some printed textual information, you know, name, address, whatever textual ID that they want to have. Then for example, on a mag stripe, like we have on our credit cards, on a mag stripe, the same information, that is a JPEG of the person's face and the same information printed on the front of the card, would be on the stripe. All that we have to do is take that information and hash it, as we've seen before, that is, create a digital signature of that information. Then, somewhere, there would be a master government public key, which would which, well, public and private key, the people generating these cards would use the private key to encrypt that digital signature. And that's basically all we need to do. What that means then is that anybody carrying the card who wanted to have its authenticity verified could present it to anyone's reader anywhere. The reader would read the mag stripe, put the information up, that is basically redisplay the photo and the textual information so that the operator could compare it to the person standing there. So in this sense, you know, the biometrics is a photo, and of course people are pretty good about comparing pictures to people's faces and deciding, oh, that was you 2 years ago kind of thing. But the key is, because this information had been digitally signed by the government, all of the readers would only need to have the government's matching public key. So any reader could verify that this information, the information on the mag stripe, not necessarily the visible information on the front of the card, but the information on the mag stripe, had not been changed by a single bit. And there's nothing then in terms of intellectual property that could be stolen from these readers. I mean, it could just be freeware that you load into a PC that has a little add-on mag stripe reader. Anybody could then verify that the digitally signed information on the mag stripe was originally signed by a government agency.
So it's really just like me using my PGP key to sign my email. You can verify that I sent you that email, that that was my key, and that the email has been untampered with, just by going to the PGP site and matching the keys.
Exactly, it's an absolutely analogous application.
Yeah.
And
okay.
You know, crypto solves the problem for us.
It's really amazing, Brian. Public key crypto, and that's what's so great about public
right.
key. Brian from Ontario, Canada writes: I know you've never had an episode specifically about keyloggers. I'm sure we'll rectify that at some point. But can a keylogger be fooled if you use a program like RoboForm, which, by the way, is a great program. I recommend it. It fills out forms for you.
Right.
To fill in your passwords. What are the ways to fool keyloggers if, a big if, a keylogger manages to get on my system? I know software firewalls can warn you if a keylogger phones home, but viruses and spyware maybe disable your software firewall, or frankly, there are hardware keystroke loggers that you'd never see.
Right. I wanted to address this because we actually did discuss key logging stuff early in our podcasts when we were talking about passwords and entering passwords. And many people came up with clever ideas for defeating keyloggers.
Oh, yeah, like, I do remember that.
Remember,
yeah.
Like typing a couple characters,
right.
Then clicking the mouse into like a notepad,
cutting
typing
and
a few more,
right.
Cutting and pasting, scrambling things. I mean, there's all kinds of things you can do if you were concerned about that. So it certainly is the case. First of all, RoboForm, which is down at the API of Windows, is not necessarily going to be proof from a keylogger, because in order to fill in these forms, most of these utilities, and in order to be like a universal form filler, many of them literally simulate the keyboard.
Oh, interesting.
Typing into the field, so that the same hooks into the system which allow a keylogger to see keystrokes will similarly see something like RoboForm typing, basically typing that information in for you.
And I guess it really depends on the keylogger too, because some are lower level than others, and others, some are higher level. I mean,
true.
If a keystroke logger is just looking for scan codes, well, it probably admits it, but if it's working at the API level, it would probably see it. So
actually, some of the things that people suggested, some of the clever ideas in the brainstorming back at the beginning of our podcast series, I thought were very workable, where nothing that was just looking at the keyboard would be able to tell where you were typing these things. So change your keyboard focus a few times,
right, right.
Putting characters in different places so that the end result of the string you want to have correct is correct, but nothing passively watching would be able to figure out what you had done.
Unless it's smart enough to be watching those fields and looking at the input in those fields. I mean, in other words, it depends on the keystroke logger.
Yeah, bottom line is you really don't want to get anything bad in your system.
No, and it's possible to put a keystroke logger on your keyboard that memorizes stuff. If you use a public terminal,
public access terminal.
Very likely, or not very likely, but very possible that your all your keystrokes are being logged. But RoboForm would avoid it in that case.
Yeah,
of course, it'd probably leave enough traces behind that it wouldn't make any difference. Brian of Everett, Washington, is concerned about MD5 hashes. In one of your cryptography podcasts, you talked about the MD5 cryptographic hash as a way to verify downloaded files. However, I just read on the internet the MD5 algorithm has recently been found to be unreliable, and hashes generated with it can be cracked. I think we talked a little bit about this. He says, is it true a different internet site talking about MD5 said you could salt an MD5 hash to prevent it from being broken? What exactly does salting a hash mean? It sounds like something they did in the Navy, but does this fix the problem, or is the MD5 algorithm truly unreliable?
Okay, there are a couple things. MD5 generates a 128-bit hash, which is beginning to be not long enough. So there are now 256-bit hashes and 512-bit hashes, which are arguably way overkill. But you know, with computers being as fast as they are and storage being as big as it is, there just isn't really a reason not to use a larger hash to prevent hash collisions, which is what adding bits, more bit length to the hash does. So on one side, it's worth mentioning that this 128-bit is a little short. But what these sites are talking about are something we discussed in the context of hashing before, which is brute forcing a hash. If you use an unsalted MD5, what sites are doing is they're pre-computing for many common passwords and passphrases that is up to a certain length. You start getting too many of them as the length grows. They pre-compute the hash. So you end up with a huge table of hashes and the password that if you hashed it would result in that hash. So what salting does, salting adds some extra fluff, some extra stuff to the input in order to completely change the output. So, for example, if you put in the word dog into an MD5 hash, you're always going to get the same 128 bits out, no matter how many times you put the word dog in. So in a pre-computation dictionary attack on MD5, the hash for dog would probably be there. If somebody tried it, then they'd be able to figure out what your password was, because you'd chosen a really bad password. I mean, there's no way that dog is a good password to have. On the other hand, if you just added, for example, a minus sign or an underscore or some sort of what's called salt to the hash, then that would completely change the output, so that you'd get, I mean, with any good hashing algorithm, a completely different set of 128 bits. So adding any other debris to the algorithm will completely change the result and render it basically uncrackable to this kind of brute force attack.
But you can't just add it to the hash. It has to be the decoding program has to know about this underscore. You can't just make up something and put it in the hash.
Well, the idea would be, for example, Unix systems use a salted MD5. They've got some junk that is unique to the system, which they always add when anyone types in a password, so that nobody who sees the resulting hash is able to, you know, basically have a universal crack for the system.
Ah, very clever.
Very clever.
Yeah, Carl Schweitzer of Hilbert, Wisconsin, managed to untangle last week's discussion of the stack and buffer overruns. Actually, a surprisingly large number of people wrote to us thanking us for it and saying they got it, and that's great. I mean, that was one of the more complicated things we've discussed in the podcast.
I think I used the term aggressively technical.
But he did have a question. He said, when it comes to the stack, why does it have to write up? Wouldn't it be more secure to write down, or is there something more complicated going on with that?
Okay, now, I didn't quite get his question.
He's talking about why does it go up in memory instead of down in memory, but I don't think that makes any difference, does it?
Actually, there's something brilliant about this, which I really liked. First of all, he says, why does it write up? Meaning, why does your, when you're overflowing the buffer, you're going from lower memory to higher memory,
right.
And that's writing up the stack, and that's overwriting the stuff that's higher in the stack, which is critical information from previous programs or previous subroutines. Because as we remember from last week, the stack grows downwards. Well, his point was, if buffers overflowed the other direction, then they wouldn't be overwriting the previous information. They'd just be writing, they'd be overwriting stuff that wasn't allocated yet on the stack. Well, he's completely correct. Now,
so why don't they do it that way?
Exactly. I mean, they should. I mean, I love the question. It's brilliant.
Wait a minute. Now, come on. You're turning years of computer science on its head, literally.
Well, okay, now, first of all, it's not easy from a practical standpoint to fill buffers downwards. That is, you know, just everything about the way we think has a buffer being filled from lower memory to higher memory.
But if you did that, you would still overwrite. You could overwrite in the negative numbers.
Well, but hold on. But if the stack instead started at the bottom and grew upwards,
yeah.
And there's no reason it can't.
Right.
If the stack started at the bottom and grew upwards.
So you're saying if it started at memory location zero.
Or, well, zero. Not everybody
not really
can start
zero.
At zero.
Let's say whatever zero is, some arbitrary zero.
And then allocating memory on the stack, you do by moving your stack pointer up to a certain amount. Now what's happened is you've reserved all of that memory below that point for your own use. Anybody else who wants some, they move the pointer up, and now they've reserved that region that they just moved the pointer across for their own purpose. And the beauty of this is the person who is currently using the stack is the so-called is like the on the top of the stack. And if stacks grew from the bottom up instead of from the top down, then buffer overruns would overrun out into unused stack space, not already used stack space. It's brilliant. I mean, it would really work. And it would solve the problem.
Somehow, I think there's more to it than that. All right. If it were that simple, wouldn't somebody have done this?
No, I don't. Because, again,
was set up long before this ever became a problem.
Exactly. That's exactly it, Leo, is that it's a little more elegant from an architectural standpoint to have, for reasons that are sort of complicated and deal with the way pointers are handled, to have the stack growing down from the top of memory is architecturally simpler. But it was just done that way basically as an arbitrary choice. Someone said, shall we have it come down from the top or up from the bottom? And it's a little simpler to have it come down from the top. But in terms of the problems that it creates, the idea that overrunning the allocation, if you're coming down from the top, you're inherently overwriting the information of someone who's already allocated information on the stack before you. If somebody else's stack, exactly. Right. But literally, if you allocate instead from the bottom up, you don't overrun. It's wonderful.
Okay. I know we're going to hear from Randall Schwartz or one of our other programmers is going to say something, but I can't think of what it could be. Maybe you're right. And maybe this is a way to design a whole new architecture. Garrett of Rochester, Minnesota is wondering about Skype security. That's what we use, of course, to do the show. He says, how could I properly configure Skype for the best security? I'm sitting behind a NAT router with universal plug-and-play turned off and all the security settings on high. Anything else I need to do for a Skype connection?
No.
Yeah, I don't do anything particular.
Exactly. Now, the one...
You're going to give away our secret.
Well, the one gotcha is that it can be useful to allow incoming connections to Skype in situations where both people who want to connect a conversation are behind NAT routers. But in this case, Garrett was asking about Skype out connections, where he's using Skype to connect to the Skype servers in order to use Skype sort of as his telephone system.
That's how Skype avoids NAT issues, is we're always going through a server to make the connection, right?
Between two users, there's a server to rendezvous the two users.
Yes, so we don't have to worry about the incoming connection because I've already established a connection with the Skype server.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So Garrett is completely secure. He's behind a NAT router, which is giving him the inherent stateful firewall action that NAT does. He's got universal plug and play turned off,
good.
So nothing nasty is able to reconfigure his router behind his back to open ports. And he's calling out, he's connecting out to the Skype servers for his Skype out service, and so nothing is able to connect back in.
But I wouldn't have an issue, I don't have an issue if you call me on Skype, right? I mean, once I've logged into Skype, anybody can call in as well.
Correct.
So, because it has a third-party server. I thought you were going to reveal our secret, which I don't want anybody to know about how we get these Skype calls to sound good, which is that we use a dedicated Skype port. What you told me to do this, and I have to say it has improved the quality of the Skype calls. Why?
Because I've configured my Skype so that I'm able to, I have basically, of course, a non-default random port where incoming Skype connections are able to reach me.
You can do that in the Skype preferences. It's in the advanced preferences.
And the reason I have a NAT hostile network configuration, as you can imagine, Leo, my security here is pretty strong. And you and I, when we were connecting, were not able to get a direct connection because my NAT router wouldn't allow it. So that our dialogue was going through a so-called super node. It was being relayed by a third party. And when you were telling me that you and I were having such great success with Skype, but you were having some trouble with other uses of Skype when you were talking to people, that's when I suggested, well, if you did the same thing, if you allowed a fixed port to come all the way in from the internet to your Skype, then basically you don't it's like you're only behind a single NAT router. That is, the person you're connecting to is only behind a single NAT router. They are always able to initiate a connection through to you, so a super node is never used, and you get this kind of Skype quality every time.
The super nodes are a clever hack that the Skype folks did so that you don't have router problems, not router problems, but you can avoid it by using a dedicated port. Now, I do that unilaterally, right? I don't have to tell them what port I'm using. I just choose a dedicated port in my connection.
Exactly.
Options.
And suddenly you're just a higher quality Skype connector location.
Do I have to open that port on my router or anything like that?
Yes, yes. You do need to have that port mapped through so that somebody, the idea is that if both people at each end of a Skype conversation are behind NAT routers, then they may not be able to negotiate to connect to each other directly on the fly for complex reasons of the way NAT works. But if either of the people will create a statically mapped port through their NAT router, then the other person can always send a packet directly to that port, and the whole Skype protocol manages making sure that everyone knows what the port is.
Now works. You know our secret. it really does work. It makes a huge difference. Not for everybody, but it does on those people who have. And do you map just TCP or is it UDP? What do you have to map?
It's just UDP.
Just UDP. Okay, now I've given away our secret. We have no advantage whatsoever anymore. That's all right. Except our great good looks. Kim White of Secunda, South Africa, wonders about securing mobile laptops. I have a question pertaining to security of notebooks. Could you guys do an episode on securing a notebook so that when, not if, it gets stolen, the data should be safe? I've seen some ideas that use USB keys and so forth that are used as tokens, but these only protect from login. What about from boot? If the drive is locked from boot, then there's almost no way that the data can be stolen. My concern is that most of my laptop users have IPs from large corporations here in South Africa. It's worth not IP addresses, intellectual property, I should say.
Right.
It's worth hundreds of millions of dollars in the open market. He's concerned, and this happens all the time. In fact, it happened very famously to the British Secret Service, whose laptops were stolen and secrets were escaped.
Well, of course, in the news from time to time, you hear about exactly this kind of problem.
Right.
A laptop, is like left unattended briefly in an airport and it disappears. Some corporation has a ton of valuable data on their laptop. Okay, there are a couple things going on. Some IBM ThinkPads actually work with the drive's serial number to lock the laptop drive so that it will not boot unless a password is given at boot time to unlock the drive. That's very good security, but it has caused problems because it is such good security that if that password is ever lost, you're hosed. I mean, there is no way short of returning the drive to the manufacturer to unlock the drive. And the problem, of course, is that this is not generally done. This is not generally available on most laptops. So a solution that is laptop specific may not be a good one either.
It's often said that if somebody has physical access to a machine, eventually they can get the data.
And that's not true.
No?
No, because, and this is going to be the topic of next week's Security Now podcast, we're going to talk about TrueCrypt.
Yeah, we love TrueCrypt.
It is a fantastic open source encryption solution. Now, what Kim's company would have to do would be, I mean, and this is not just trivial to do, but the idea would be that most laptops are configured with everything sitting in one single huge C partition, you know, from a Windows drive designation standpoint. What you need to do is do some preparation for this. The idea being that you create another drive where all of the intellectual property resides. And you just have the discipline to keep everything that you need to have safe in this second drive. And then a program like TrueCrypt, which we'll be talking about next week, is able to provide unbreakable, I mean truly state-of-the-art, you know, past the end of the time of the universe style encryption to prevent anyone from accessing that inadvertently. And it can be configured so that if the drive is turned off, if it goes into standby, if it's unattended for a certain length of time, that you must re-enter a password in order to access that contents. And it works for laptops, it works, well, you know, for PC, desktops, anything. TrueCrypt is a fantastic solution, which is why we're going to be covering it in detail next week.
Generally, people set TrueCrypt so that it automatically unlocks once you log in. So you might want to put on the BIOS passwords and the login passwords and all of that stuff just to, you know, keep it a little more difficult to log into the computer.
Well, yes, certainly if what you're suggesting is that they have TrueCrypt configured so that you don't need to enter a password.
Which is for convenience is good.
Then you've basically defeated the whole purpose.
I understand. But if you turn on the, you haven't really, because as long as you trust Windows login, XP's login to be secure.
Right.
Because if they remove the hard drive, they're not going to be able to log in. Without your password.
Yeah,
by the way, Macs have the similar, built into the operating system, a similar strong encryption called File Vault. Does the same thing as TrueCrypt does. But it also is set to, when you log in, unlock. And in that case, you want to modify your firmware so that nobody can change the master password.
Right.
But a good system. We like TrueCrypt. You can even put it on a USB key. Ben, writing anonymously from his Gmail account, asks, the question is probably really dumb. Maybe that's why I wanted to be anonymous. But I have looked every place for somewhere to download PGP, and every site I try leads me to the same place, pgp.com. He doesn't want PGP Desktop 9.0, which isn't free. Can you please send me a link to a site where you can download a free PGP program?
Well, and Leo, we know what that is.
Yes.
And you talk about it, and it's what you use.
It's what I use, which is the open source version of PGP. The story is long and tangled. I mean, Phil Zimmerman originally made PGP open source, but the assets of PGP and the intellectual property was sold to a corporation, which still, if you search at pgp.com long enough, offers a free version. But it's a long, hard search and not worth it when you can just go to GNU Privacy Guard, GNUPG.org, and download an open source free version of PGP. And that's what I use on the Mac, and everybody should just use that.
Right. Well, when I saw this question from Ben, I just went to Google and put in GNU space PGP, GNU PGP,
right,
and took me right there.
Yeah.
So that's how anybody can find it.
They call it GNU Privacy Guard to avoid the
copyright,
trademark issues at PGP.
Yeah.
But so GNUPG.org will do the job. And it's great. I mean, it works on all machines. It uses PGP-style keys. In fact, I'm reusing PGP keys that I made. It's completely interoperable.
Well, and PGP is now an RFC standard. There's an RFC associated
Good.
With it.
So yeah.
It's been well-defined.
So you don't have to go to the PGP Corporation to get PGP.
To get real PGP.
Yes, it's real PGP even without it. Jason in Madison, Wisconsin received a nasty gram from his corporate IT department. Oh, I hate those. He writes, I just received a nasty gram essentially stating that I must remove Skype from my laptop because, quote, it is P2P or peer-to-peer software that lets viruses in, end quote. Their words, not mine. What are the security risks posed by Skype? I realize my company may have a bandwidth issue regarding the SuperNode feature in Skype, but is there something else Skype users should be aware of? That's a great question.
Well, it is, and I wanted to first say that if this is a corporate laptop and it's their property, then you want to make sure this doesn't get escalated beyond a nasty gram.
Because they can do anything they want.
Yes, you could argue that this is their computer you're using, I mean, if that's the case, and that they have a right to specify what software is used on it not.
Even
so
if
forth.
You bring your computer into the corporate network, they can tell you what programs you may and may not use. I mean,
sure.
That's their right. It's their resource.
Exactly. So... He brings up the issue of SuperNode, which we were just talking about, and about the bandwidth being consumed, and it sounds like his corporate IT department somehow discovered that he was using Skype on his laptop. All of that sounds like he does not have a firewall running on his laptop.
Because you can't be a SuperNode if you have a router or a firewall.
Exactly. SuperNodes are random Skype users who are not behind a NAT router or a firewall, who suddenly discover that they're being used as a relay point for other people that Skype cannot otherwise connect between.
And we should point out that should be a small number of people getting smaller all the time. I mean, who's on the internet without a firewall or a router? Come on.
And it is an annoyance that Skype provides no user interface option.
You can't turn it off.
Exactly, for disallowing SuperNode usage of your own client. So I would tell Jason that if he wants to continue using Skype, and I would imagine he's behind Windows XP or he's using Windows XP, that if he turns on the Service Pack 2 firewall that ought to be built in or uses any third-party firewall so that inbound connections are not allowed, he should be able to use Skype without any trouble, and there's no way his IT department could ever determine that that's what he was doing. But again, I'm not suggesting that he goes against the wishes of his corporate IT people, but their argument that Skype is peer-to-peer and therefore is, and for that reason should not be used, I think that doesn't hold much water. But I can certainly understand them not wanting to get into all this.
As they're right not to, but I think they're conflating it with the Napster or Morpheus or one of those peer-to-peer. It's not peer-to-peer that way.
Right.
Yeah. Although I think there is some kind of tenuous connection with Kazaa, I seem to remember. But that's not the peer-to-peer.
The Kazaa guys who figured out NAT traversal,
right,
who then started Skype and used that NAT traversal technology from their peer-to-peer experience in order to create a system that just works behind NAT router so easily.
But it's not sharing music. You're not allowing virus. I don't think there's any way. I mean, it's not allowing viruses in, is it? No. Of course not.
No.
No. Not unless somebody sends you a file and you accept it.
Well, in fact, at the beginning of this podcast, Leo, I sent you a PDF, and we used Skype in order to send to do a file transfer because it worked just beautifully.
And you can do that in chat clients and instant messenger clients and so forth.
Right.
In fact, the truth is, if they allow any instant messenger at all, it's no different than Skype. I mean, AIM, Yahoo, all of these offer voice over the internet in very much the same way Skype does.
Right.
Russell of Salt Lake City asks, we all know that chat clients,
speak of the devil,
chat clients like MSN, AIM, and Yahoo Messenger are about as insecure as it gets as far as the channel of communication goes. My question is regarding Google Chat. I'm not talking about the standalone Google Chat client, but that when you log into your Gmail account, this is something new they just added, using HTTPS, colon/gmail.google.com. In that web interface, you're able to conduct chats. So my question is, I'm inside the secure server, HTTPS. I'm encrypted and secure. Or is it using a different port? I mean, is my chat secure?
Right. Well, this is really interesting, and I thought this was a great question. You have security guaranteed by HTTPS, that is, by an SSL connection, which we know is really good security, from your browser to Google. The problem is everything that you are chatting with then goes through Google's servers. And who's to say that next year Google's not going to announce, hey, by the way, you can search for everything you ever chatted about.
Which they might.
Because we've been sucking it all in and keeping it forever.
It's a possibility.
Google tends to do that. So, with our government becoming increasingly concerned about, terrorist activities within our borders and all of this NSA eavesdropping and, now all of our phone records being sucked up and analyzed, I would be concerned using any third-party server to be the relay point for my chats. There is a very good, very secure chat client called Bitwise IM.
Oh, yeah, we like that.
Yes. In fact, you and I, Leo, use it because it also offers VoIP services, although the quality still wasn't up to... Oh, in fact, it uses the Speaks codec, which is why we gave it a try, but it still wasn't up to what the GIPS, the Global IP Sound technology that Skype is using, is able to give us. So we backed away from it for our podcast recordings. But Bitwise space IM, if you just go to Google and put in Bitwise IM for Instant Messenger... I know the author. I've interacted with him. In fact, I've worked with him to improve his NAT traversal technology so that it works a lot better than it did before. This guy's a neat guy. It's cross-platform, Mac, Linux, and Windows. And it just looked, if you're looking for something that isn't a huge bullseye, that isn't the same sort of target that MSN and AIM and Yahoo and Google are, where you want to do point-to-point chat and not run through a third-party server. Oh, and everything is encrypted. So it's very strongly encrypted chat. It's what I would recommend.
There are corporate versions available of AIM and MSN that provide encryption as well. But this is just, you just download it. It's free and it's easy to use.
Yep.
That's great. David from Bossier City, Louisiana, discovered Security Now 2 weeks ago. Welcome, David. And he says he just finished listening to all 39 episodes. Whoa! Okay. He must be a little exhausted right now.
I love that.
Yeah, I think that's great. He had a question about Linux, open source, and buffer overruns. He says, unless I'm misunderstanding something, I would think there would be more exploits from buffer overruns with Linux, since it's open source, and a programmer could see all the problems in the code easier than Windows. In other words, could find these holes. Or... does that make it less likely to have problems with things like buffer overruns because of the number of eyes looking at the code in the open source community? I ask because I would think this may be one of the great concepts that comes from the open source community and wondered your thoughts. This is actually a common area of discussion among open source folks.
I would say that it is the big unresolved issue. That's why I thought this was a great question that David had posed. It's a religious battle. In the same way that, Mac versus Windows is sort of a religious thing.
Closed versus open source.
Exactly. Closed versus open. What is more secure? You made a comment that I didn't react to last week when we were talking about buffer overruns, which was that many of these are discovered by people just pounding on the code. And in fact, the guys at EI down in Aliso Viejo, they've got a room full of machines that just throw junk at software. And when one of those machines crashes, it's because they just found some new buffer overrun.
So they basically have a million monkeys in a room trying to crack it.
Yeah, and
that's
the guys are finding
software
stuff all the time,
right,
in exactly this fashion.
Whereas you could look at a source listing of a program, if you were really an accomplished programmer or accomplished hacker, and perhaps find buffer overflows. I guess, it comes down to the choice of security through obscurity, that is, you're secure because it's kind of hidden, or true security, which is that it's open, it's exposed, And you know, people, yes, will find it, but people will also fix it right away. I bet on open source, to be honest with you, but that is a religious battle. You're right.
My sense is that from a programmer standpoint, if there were backdoors deliberately programmed into code, those would be found immediately
right.
in an open source environment.
Which is why PGP was open. I wouldn't trust any encryption program that wasn't open source. Because you need to know what they put in there.
And so that's the advantage of open source. But the nature of buffer overruns is that it wasn't clear to the programmer who wrote it. And when you look at the source code, there's this inherent tendency to adopt that same mindset and to sort of follow along with the code. It's just so hard to see the mistakes that somebody has made, even when you're looking at it. So I don't think that open source would be more secure because people would tend to find other people's mistakes. People tend to just read along and, you know, get through the job that they're doing. It's more the case that you find these things sort of just by pounding on the code, exactly as you had said last week, Leo.
And there's certainly, I mean, the truth is there have been plenty of buffer overflow exploits in open source software. It's certainly no programmer's immune from it.
That's a very good point.
You know, here's the question. I mean, if you write a module or a part of a major open source program, is anybody going to rewrite it or check it for security? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
Well, that's a very good point, too. It's cool that this source is open, but many people wonder if anyone else ever looks at the source code again.
I mean, in theory, they do. I mean, there's somebody with commit access to an open source project who is supposed to review all of this stuff. But it's, you know, I mean, yeah, I think there's no guarantee it's been highly reviewed.
Well, yeah. A perfect example is my use of a news server. A GRC runs a very active, wonderful set of news groups relating to security and privacy. Anyone who's got a news reader, and in fact everybody who is using a contemporary browser, probably has a news reader built in. You can just go, you can aim your news reader at news.grc.com, and we've got a news server with a bunch of fantastic news groups there. Well, I've got all kinds of extra features that over the years I've built into our news server, like we have secure authentication, and people who post notices are able to delete theirs, but nobody else can delete theirs. And I've taken the open source standard INN news server, and thanks to it being open source, I've gone in and made a whole bunch of custom enhancements for, you know, basically turning it into a hybrid, adding a bunch of GRC stuff, which I would never have been able to do if it were just some new server I'd bought in executable code fashion and then inherently been unable to modify. So it's a boon for a programmer, but it's not clear to me, you know, that from a standpoint of, you know, tons of people going over the source code if problems are going to be found that way.
We'll win you over yet, Steve. You're getting you're starting to sound like an open source kind of guy, I have to say. You know, it also depends on how low level the code is. I think if it's a PHP message boards system, a lot more people are looking at the code than if it's an assembly language kernel module. So.
Well, and that's a perfect example, too, of something that is very vulnerable. A PHP-based message board system is inherently, you know, it's like sticking its face out there on the net looking for someone to find a way to exploit it.
Right.
And, of course, we know that there's just, you know, PHP exploits by the hundreds a month.
Right, right. Our last question. Paul Winters, nestled in the Colorado Rockies, asks, I'd love to hear your comments, Steve, on recent legislative proposals to have ISPs maintain logs of all activity. What good would this be if a user is using VPN or encryption of any kind?
He is completely correct. I mean, it is disturbing when we see legislation, I mean, and the ISPs are as disturbed as their users.
Well, they don't want to do this.
No, it's a huge burden. The idea being that they've got to maintain logs for law enforcement to use in order to track down illicit activity. I mean, it's a good thing if it works. It's hugely burdensome for ISPs, and then you end up, you know, with people feeling like their ISPs are spying on them. Much as we do now with, you know, all of our phone records going to the government for processing and analysis. And so the question was, does running all this traffic through a VPN solve the problem? And the answer is yes. There is, again, contemporary VPN technology cannot be broken. And all an ISP would have is, I mean, literally random bits of data. Because as we know from our security podcasts, once you have true security, the data that results from good encryption is indistinguishable from random noise.
Yeah.
So that's all an ISP would be able to see.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I'm using encryption more and more. Although, you know, in Britain, the House of Commons, I guess, just proposed a bill. I'm not sure where the bill came from.
To legislate against encryption?
No, to make it illegal. Actually, no, I take it back. This has always been the law, but they've never enforced it. Now they're talking about enforcing it, that you must reveal your password or decrypt if requested to by law enforcement. And if you don't, you just go straight to jail.
Wow.
And I think that that's going to be a concomitant of any kind of move like this. If they're starting to log all the information and the encryption is widely available, well, you've got to pass a law saying that you have to hand over the keys.
So that's interesting. So the idea being that if they capture a bunch of this random noise we're talking about,
they can go to the guy.
And they say to you, you must tell us. Yeah, exactly. Basically, we are legally compelling you to decrypt this data so that we can see it. You have to or suffer the consequences.
Go to jail anyway.
Wow.
Whether you've done anything wrong or not. I have a feeling that every major industrial nation will pass laws like this because that's the only way to deal with encryption and crime, especially as encryption becomes more well known and commonly available.
Yeah. Here we've been talking about the NSA literally eavesdropping on the content of calls where they have reason to suspect that there's something bad going on, and it's like, well, okay, all you have to do is use VoIP and encrypt it, because we know no one, as far as we know, not even the NSA, is able to decrypt deeply encrypted, you know, state-of-the-art encryption. On the flip side, if this legislation passes, then all they do is collect the data and compel you to decrypt it.
That's right.
Wow. I mean, it makes sense, but you know, it's not easy to feel so smug now about encryption.
Yeah. In fact, there's some move that the UK may actually, ahead of time, ask businesses to hand over the cryptographic keys, just in case. Just in case. I tell you, I don't want to get you upset. I know how you feel about these things.
Where can we move to?
Nowhere. That's the problem. Now, that's why one of the things we like about TrueCrypt is this plausible deniability. It doesn't even look like encrypted data. It just looks like noise.
Yep.
But if you've got noise, I guess you could say if you were on your internet service provider and sending something that sounded like noise, you could say, oh, what are you talking about? That must have just been a burst of noise.
Prove that it's not.
Encryption? What encryption?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, in fact, it is not possible to prove that encrypted data is not random noise.
Right. So maybe that's our defense.
There we go. We solved the problem.
I hope. Yeah, good luck. Do we have a plan for next week, or are we going to wing it?
Well, if you're not going to make me prove that a stack is much better,
I guarantee you I'm going to hear from Randall Schwartz and he's going to explain why there's no other way to do it. But anyway, we'll see. Maybe, you know, he could very well send me an email saying, you're right. Why didn't I think of that? But other than that, do you have any other ideas?
Next week is TrueCrypt.
Oh, we'll do TrueCrypt. Great.
Yep.
Can't wait. That'll be a lot of fun. We do thank you for joining us. And, of course, we do give a lot of credit to SpinRight because that is Steve's day job. And without it, well, we'd have to find a way to pay him or something.
It keeps the lights on and it helps people all the time.
Yeah, it's wonderful. If you want to read some testimonials for how people have used SpinRight to recover their data, to save their drives, to save their lives, go to spinrite.info, SPINRITE.info. Go to grc.com/securitynow.htm. I guess you can go to securitynow.info for a while anyway to get the show notes, 16 kilobit versions of the show for the bandwidth impaired, and full transcripts, thanks to Elaine, of each and every show. And, of course, Steve's notes about the topics we talk about. It's also a good place to read the security news groups that he has going there at grc.com. And even submit your questions for future editions of Security Now. GRC.com. That's the home of SpinRite and Security Now. Thanks to our friends at AOL Radio for providing the bandwidth for this podcast. AOL.com/podcasting. And thanks to you, Steve Gibson, for being such a dude.
I always enjoy this, Leo. It's
really fun. Thank you. We'll see you next Thursday on Security Now.
Security Now.